The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So let me give you a little more background for this, or teaching about this. Sixteen stages of mindfulness of breathing. I think some of you have read the discourse on the mindfulness of breathing. It correlates the 16 stages with the four foundations of mindfulness. So if the first tetrad correlates with mindfulness of the body, the second tetrad correlates with mindfulness of vedana, feeling tone. The third tetrad correlates with mindfulness of mind. And the fourth tetrad, which we started today, correlates with mindfulness of the Dharma. And as I said earlier, there's a shift here in the fourth tetrad towards understanding, towards seeing. And so we're seeing impermanence now. And it has to do with, in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, has to do with seeing the patterns and the relationships that the mind forms that bring suffering, and the patterns and relationships of the mind that bring freedom, that bring liberation. And so there's something about seeing impermanence in a very deep, thorough way, which is really key in changing, having a changed relationship to the world and to all aspects of the world. A change of relationship that leads towards liberation. So in order for that to be, have this kind of very deep, excuse me, this deep, there's water here. I have one. This, in order for it to have this deep, transformative role in our lives, the insight into impermanence has to be very, very thorough. And part of the challenge of it is the thoroughness in which we see it. You know, as I said earlier, we can all see the impermanence of, you know, the seasons and of, you know, the day. And there's a lot of obvious impermanence in daily life. But to actually see it in the thoroughly, meaning thoroughly in the functioning of the very mind itself, and how our experience of the world, any perception of the world, that perception itself is impermanent. So even though I might say that this bell here is a permanent bell, permanent for the time being, for the time being it's not going to change its bellness too much. This is what it is. We're not going to melt it or anything. But the perception of the bell is something that gets, it's a construct of the mind. There are some people who wouldn't know this was a bell. They've never seen this thing before. They thought this is a perfect bowl. It looks like a Buddhist begging bowl. Or they think it's a pot for cooking in or something. And it could be a pot. You can probably do a pretty good job cooking certain things. Or it could work as a begging bowl. In fact, many years ago, I was in downtown San Francisco, and I passed this guy who was begging, and he had an exquisite Japanese little bell, metal bell that he was begging with. And by the time I was a block away, I said, you know, I should have bought it from him. I don't know where he got it, but, you know, that... for him, it was a begging bowl. I've used this as a book stand up here sometimes. I put my books on here. You've seen that. So the point being that the perception of the bell is not inherent in this object. The perception is something that I'm constructing, and all of us together are constructing. It's a collective construction, but it's still an activity. It's construction, but in that construction, it's not a, you know, once you've done it, it's set forever. It's constantly being reconstructed, and so that the perception is much more impermanent than the object, the bell. So this thoroughness of a thorough understanding of impermanence, you may get a little bit better sense of it when you have to actually look and start noticing that the perception, the activity of perceiving something, is also arising and passing. And so that's it brings some interesting questions, like if who you think you are is a perception that's arising in the moment and passing in the moment, who are you in between the perceptions? Well, who are you when you don't have any thoughts to tell you who you are in between the thoughts? You know, you're still alive, but who are you? What is that place? And so that vantage point of seeing the perceptions of things as something that's arising and passing, and seeing the perceiving of the world arise and passes very, very quickly, and that everything that we perceive, we don't really perceive the world in some absolute, you know, direct way of what the world really is. What we see is we see it through the filter of our capacities for perception, through any of the sense organs at all. And that activity of perception, perceiving arises in passing. And when we cling, we don't cling to things. Even though I might be holding on to, physically holding on to the bell, I'm not really holding on, you know, my mind is not holding on to the, my mind's holding on to the perception of bellness. If someone told me this was a spittoon, you know, I'm not going to hold it the same way. I'm not going to put my finger deep inside, hold this, you know, and grab on this way. You know, I'm grabbing it because this way, because I see it as a bell, supposedly. What we cling to is not the object, but in a psychological sense, we're clinging to the perception we have of objects. And this is often known, you know, we know that to some degree, maybe some of you hopefully know, this plays itself out also in relationships, right? You know, we don't necessarily cling to the person, we cling to the idea of the person, the projection, the transference, the aspiration, the hope, the, you know, all the stuff that the person's, we dumped on that poor person. and so then they don't cooperate with our perception, you know, the way it's supposed to be. So there's some degree, the point being that the clinging has a lot to do with perception. And perception is a construct of the mind. So what happens if the perception, you see the perception arising and passing, and you realize all you can cling to is perception, but the perception is fleeting. If the perception stays constant, which it usually does, you know, the bell is the bell, it doesn't change. Right? But if I see it as fleeting, then as soon as I try to grab onto the concept or the perception of bell, that's all I have is perception, I don't really have a bell. As soon as I try to grab onto it, it's like sand or water, you know, kind of, it disappears through my fingers. So you can't hold onto it. So the thoroughness of impermanence, the perception of impermanence that can happen when the mind is really concentrated and really still, it's like having a magnifying glass, you really see what's much more the game of how it's played at the perceptual level. And you realize that's all you have. And you realize that you can't grab any of it. Then it becomes hard to you know, and you don't want to or you can't. And so that's one of the ways in which the tendency, this very deeply ingrained tendency we have to grab, to cling, begins to lessen. When you realize you can't cling. There's nothing exists in such a way that you can psychologically cling to it. So that's one of the medicine that Buddhism offers for trying to uproot this very strong tendency to cling, is to have this meditative, deep meditative experience. In that experience, it's not possible to cling. You can't, you know, you realize how pointless it is to cling. So that movement to go out and grab, you know, just doesn't compute. You know, so it begins to soften that. So what happens with it? So what I'm trying to convey here is that there's a deep shift in our understanding of the world, at least temporarily, in deep meditation, when we see the things as being impermanent, or when we see how impermanence operates at the perceptual level, how impermanence operates at the psychological level. Now, some Buddhists will say that what we're seeing is the radical impermanence of the world. So if I look at the bell, and you know, and moment by moment the bell seems to dissolve and come back together, arise and pass, they'll say, oh, the bell, it's so inherent in the nature of the physics of the world that the world is impermanent. And that goes just along with modern physics, doesn't it? These Buddhists, they were way ahead of the game. That's not what Buddhism is trying to say. Buddhism is not a physics about impermanence in the world. What it is psychology. It's a of how perception works, how experience works. We experience the bell as being impermanent. There's no claim about the bell being impermanent, the world being impermanent. You see the difference? Do you not see the difference? Anybody? You don't see the difference? You don't see the difference? Yeah. So, we all know that this bell is impermanent to some degree. Sooner or later, it's going to be a bell. It'll crack and break. We'll throw it away or melt it or something. But for the time being, it's relatively stable. But in deep meditation, the mind is very still and concentrated. It's possible to see the arising and passing of the bell. Now, some of people might say, oh, I'm seeing it at an atomic level, the physical atomic level, and I can see that the physicists are right, that it's just everything is so impermanent and fleeting and rising and passing. And so Buddhism is really showing me the true nature of existence, of reality. But what I don't think that's quite accurate. I think what's accurate to say is that we're not seeing the bell. We're seeing the bell in a certain kind of way, but what this deep meditation practice is doing is showing us something about the nature of the perceptual process. And the perceptual process is perceiving things arising and passing. So the radical impermanence of deep meditation is not meant to be a translation to seeing now. So bell is one thing, but when your eyes closed, people in deep meditation will experience their body as being almost like teeny little. People talk about atomic level, seeing the atomic level of the body, the rising and passing of these little kalapas, these atoms, these sensations. And it feels very, very precise, very small, minute, almost vibrating and pulsing and arising and passing of these very, very precise small things. And it's possible to say that some people then conclude from that, oh, I'm seeing the true nature of the body, the physical quality of the body as being so impermanent. And I think that's going a step too far from what the evidence allows us to conclude. But what we conclude is that our perception, the perceptual process of the body, we see things as arising and passing. So in terms of seeing things externally, I haven't had this experience, but I've known people who have looked at a tree coming out of deep meditation, and the tree just is dissolving kind of in front of their eyes. We know the tree is not dissolving. What's happening is the perceptual process. And probably what's happening is their mind is so quick. They're seeing, just like the looking at if you slow down the movie on the movie screen, you know, it's kind of the sense of movement stops. So if you speed up the ability to see clearly what's going on moment by moment, you see that for a moment there's a tree, and then the moment the perception tree falls away. The moment the tree falls away. Normally, we just see it's just one, you know, tree that continues all the time. So it's a perceptual process, and it's not so important to have this experience in and of itself. It isn't important to have this deep insight into the nature of reality for its own sake. What's important for it is how it helps the mind loosen its grip of clinging. That's really the point. What's important is to see how we change how the appreciation or the seeing of impermanence helps to shift our relationship in a healthy direction, the way we relate to this world we live in. Does this make some sense? Yeah, people now who were not nodding before are nodding now. Yeah.
If it's just our perception that it's about and not the true nature, that we're not actually seeing the true nature of reality, but just we're
true
looking at our
perception.
Yeah. then maybe we're grasping for something that is real.
And I don't follow this.
Well, maybe the clinging is to something that's real.
Right.
It's just our perception that's askew.
Try saying a different way.
What the truth is that we're not saying something true about what reality is. We're saying something true about what our perception is.
Our relationship to it all, how we experience
right.
it. Yeah.
So, if it's only our perception that's askew, that's deluded, why is then does that loosen our grip on? I mean, the grip is maybe is something is real that we're grabbing onto, that we're clinging to.
Oh, maybe we are grabbing onto something real.
Yeah.
Well, if you're standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon, hold on to the railing. You know, that's pretty important. But I think what we're trying to do is to understand the nature of suffering, and how suffering arises out of clinging. And if we start getting a sense of that, then we try to find a way to loosen up that clinging. And so much of our experience of life and ourselves and how we relate to the world has to do with how we perceive the world. And there's a misperception that goes on about much of the nature of how things work. And so part of the function of insight meditation is to shift that perception enough that we develop a more healthy or a more useful understanding of what is actually going on here. And so one of the things that's going on is that the perceptual process allows us to see things arising and passing all the time. And to have a deep insight into that experience of arising and passing, we realize that we can't grasp psychologically to anything in that state, in that meditation. And for the mind to have the experience of not grasping at all, completely non-grasping, is a radical thing for the mind to do. It's like someone who's always been working, and then they never was told they could have to take a vacation, and then finally they had a vacation. So, wow, this is different. So finally, your mind gets the lesson. Wow, I don't have to be. I could take a vacation from all this grasping. This is different. This is nice. This makes some sense to me. And so what we'll see on this fourth tetrad is it involves, we'll see this in the next class we meet, that it involves that the experience of impermanence sets the stage for a changing relationship, a series of changing relationships to the world or to ourselves, you know, to what experience is. And that changing relationship then is sets a stage for liberation. But there has to be something that has it, so there's a step-by-step change that goes on. Yeah.
Does this happen only in deep meditation, only in concentrated states, or can it happen in normal day-to-day experience?
Yeah. Anything can happen, but say it this way: there are three kinds of impermanence a person can experience. There's the impermanence that is that anybody can see. You don't have to be a meditator to see it. The days change, the seasons change, you know, those things. Anybody can see it. And then there's a kind of impermanence that comes from deep vipassana practice, deep insight work, and requires the mind to be very, very focused and very mindful. Mindfulness has to be at a very strong level. And that's one of the things we're cultivating in mindfulness practice, is strengthening the mindfulness and concentration so we have an ability to see, not at the usual way, not the usual conceptual way in which we see things, but rather seeing things at a much more subtle level of how things operate. So seeing at that subtle level, we see, for example, that there's concepts of experience, and then there's what's below concept of experience. And some of what we see below concept of experience is more closely related to what's actually happening there. So for example, physical pain. If we see it through concept, it seems pretty permanent. But if you can drop below the ideas of pain, some people report they'll see that the pain is not a constant, but it's in flux and moving and pulsing and sparking and doing all these different things. And they have a very different relationship to it because they see it that way. So some of it is that some of it is in fact the nature of the body to be pulsing and shaking and doing all these different things. So it's not just we can't just I'll just say it's only perception is kind of you know, you don't want to say it too quickly. But it requires having this ability to drop below the conceptual level and have this very deep ability to keep the mind still and quiet in order to see that way. As the practice goes deeper, at some point there's a shift in mindfulness practice, and everything that our attention turns toward, everything we become aware of, just seems like it's just dissolving, just kind of shimmering, or just kind of sparking in and out of existence, no matter what. So especially the body. It's just the body just seems. Some people there's all kinds of ways in which people report this or feel this, but one is that its body just feels like sand particles kind of going through an hourglass or a washing, kind of going through the fingers. Kind of just there's no solidity in the body at all, and everything becomes very light and fluid and very minute and kind of rising and passing. And at this level, I think it's safer to say what we're seeing is the impermanent nature of the perceptual process. Now, at that level, I don't know how well we can actually do it driving in the car. You know, I think probably if that begins happening, you should pull the car over. And it isn't that we're supposed to walk around all the time that way. It's just that this is a very it's a very deep it's a particular kind of approach to meditation practice that leads to a certain result. It's a freeing of clinging. Does that answer your question? To respond to your question, you think? Or?
You said there was three.
Oh, three. Yeah. So that's two. So the ordinary, what everyone can see, the kind that can only be seen through this kind of what we call vipassana, this deep insight work. And the third is the kind of impermanence that leads to liberation. And so it's a particular kind of insight into impermanence that is a trigger for the mind to let go entirely. And this is usually called in Buddhism the gate of impermanence, of emptiness. There's this it's called a gate, called a gate of emptiness. And if you go through that gate of emptiness, it's from having seen impermanence in such a deep way that the mind gives up all attempts to hold on to anything at all. Yes. Bye.
Trying to take this to a more manageable level. It seems to me that the work that I do in meditation then carries over and the insight comes, and that experience of insight is a change in my perception of what this relationship was or what this problem was.
Right.
So is that anywhere near what you're talking about, but on a much deeper level?
Yeah. So there's all these almost like layers that we can understand our life by. Maybe it's this way, that there's ordinary or impermanence that we can all see, and sometimes people are ignoring it, and then suddenly something happens and we see it and we realize we have to take into account death and sickness and all these kinds of impermanent things. Ordinary. And then there's what can be seen through mindfulness, which is you might see that a relationship is a projected idea of permanence, projected idea. And you're able to kind of, because of the mindfulness, to drop the concept and see much more who the person really is, not your projection and all that. That's mindfulness. When mindfulness gets coupled with concentration, then and it's deep meditation, then it becomes a whole different level of seeing this as well. But it also involves a changing relationship. So in a sense, this fourth tetrad, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, is about a change of relationship to our experience. So the relationship we have to experience is liberating rather than bonding, rather than keeping us in bondage, getting caught. So I don't know, did I respond, you think, to you well enough? To your concern? Did I respond well enough? To you? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think most people have had the experience a number of times of when you look at a printed word with a lot of focus, it suddenly starts to lose its meaning, and the idea that it had the meaning normally ascribed to it starts to seem absurd. Now, we don't normally get attached to the meaning of a printed word, but I imagine the same kind of thing can happen with the things we do get attached to if we look at it closely enough. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Sure. That's good. So a whole other way of looking at this is that to some degree, the perception of permanence, the activity of the mind that perceives things as permanent, requires the mind to be fixated, sort of fixation of the mind. And so when the mind, when you're developing mindfulness, you're loosening up the fixation. And so that's one of the reasons why the mind gets softer and softer when you do this practice. Because the mind is not fixated. Yes?
So, of the three stages, after that third stage, and somebody's had truly very deep insights, and things appear to be dissolving, then when they're back in the regular world, is that perception of change constant? Or
generally, when people come out of meditation, the world comes, the usual way of perceiving the world comes back. And so, but however, what's changed is that their relationship to the world is less going to be less fixated, less clinging, hopefully less clinging. And so sometimes, whenever there's deep concentration, there's sometimes where the mind still has a tendency for a while, has a habit of going into strong states of concentration. And so sometimes in daily life there can be a little bit of awkwardness for a while for some people, until it kind of settles out. Because, you know, you don't just kind of pop out of meditation at the end of a retreat and, you know, go back to normal. Yes, but what's important is not that you leave the meditation with an altered perception. What's important, ideally what we're trying to do is to leave meditation with an altered relationship. And so the relationship now is one we're not inclined to cling to it.
See if I can ask this in the right way. So in ordinary perception, we see things change in a very gross way. And in meditation, we start to see how things that we thought were permanent actually have some flux, or there's constant change in what it is that we're perceiving, that you can't look at something and it stays solid, in the sense that, for example, if you hear a sound that's continuous, you all of a sudden start to realize that it's made up of lots and lots of little blips that make the sound continuous.
Well, that's the open question. We kind of know the sound maybe is blips, or kind of, you know, it's waves or with the come and go. But are we really perceiving that at that level? Because what happens between the sound traveling through the air and our perceiving of the sound, there's also the electrical things that go on, right? And that also happening in a pulsing way. And then there's the reconstruction of it, the perception of it is also happening as an activity. So at what level of impermanence, where we're seeing it, that impermanence, that's an open question. And it's quite common for Buddhists to say, I see the impermanence of the sound. And I'm just saying, we have to be careful to make that conclusion. It's more likely we're seeing the impermanence of the perceptual process.
But at some point you start to realize that your perception of whatever it was is shaky.
Yes.
And that's when the insight comes into saying, that's no longer necessarily a bell.
Right.
So that you don't get wrapped up into the idea of bellness.
Right.
And then you can let go of it.
Well, I think that can happen before that's such a deep level. So that's why I kind of want to revise what I said about three levels of impermanence. There's four. There's ordinary level. There's what can happen when you have good mindfulness. And then that's a second. And the third is when you have strong vipassana. Vipassana means insight. So when the mindfulness has not just ordinary mindfulness, it allows you to see. I mean, anybody can kind of have the mindfulness enough to see, oh yeah, I was just making this up to be a bell. You know, actually, you know, it can make a great sapatoon. And so to kind of loosen up the concepts and all that doesn't require deep insight. But when mindfulness is coupled with strong concentration, then we have very radically different perception that's more than just seeing through the conceptual level. But we have to see beyond the conceptual level to see this deeper level. So I don't know if I'm making sense for you, but Mary.
I'm listening to this and it's interesting and I'm thinking, well, it's not really something I can think my way into, and so I'm just sort of letting it be there. But I'm remembering a story I heard you tell a long time ago about a monk who was in the monastery and he was going to be the best monk there, and each year he went through some process and the abbot just kept saying to him, it's all empty, it's all empty. And I've thought about that story ever since I heard it. And now when you said the gate of emptiness, I'm going, oh, this is what this guy experienced. But he tried for years and years to get there through his mind. And so I think as I hear you talk about it, it's okay, I don't fully get what you're saying. I mean, I get it, you know, up here, but I'm not having that experience, and I don't think I can will it to happen.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I started off this morning by saying that it's one thing to have knowledge, it's another thing to have the knowledge have impact. And so it's one thing to understand in principle things are impermanent. But what does it take to have that impermanence, have a real experience of impermanence, to have a deep impact? So it changes us. And so the suggestion in the Buddhist tradition is that meditation practice is very important so that we can see and experience at a much deeper level than the cognitive or the thinking level. Because you can't think your way into this. And it's not just a matter of calming yourself either. Not that, you know, calming and calmer and concentrated and still and thinking that's going to do it. The concentration or stillness is not going to do it by itself. Concentration or stillness is a window that allows us to understand or see in a new way. And that seeing in the new way, that new understanding, that understanding is what is transformative, not the stillness, not the joy or the rapture of meditation.
And you only get there from, I mean, I think I only can get there just to keep sitting, and whatever I get is what I get. But, you know, I sometimes sit here and think, well, I want to sit and I want it to happen, but it's not going to work that way.
So one of the dangers of me talking the way I'm talking today about, you know, deep stages of meditation, deep experiences, you know, that people, there's something I'm supposed to get and I'm supposed to kind of, you know, and, you know, when, why are you talking about this at the end of the day? You know, I don't have enough time now. You should have mentioned it at the beginning. And And I think it's helpful that Buddhist meditation, Buddhist practice, is really a practice to help us become free of suffering, of clinging. And that's first and foremost. And that's something that can happen, and it's to some degree can happen here and now, right now. And if you start thinking, I need to get to some deep place in meditation and cling to it, then you just, you know, it doesn't work that way. So here and now, you can have an experience. You can see. To some degree, you can see, oh, I'm holding on to something. I'm clinging to something. And an expectation, a wanting, and all kinds of stuff. What can I let go of now, here and now? What's available to me here and now that I can let go of so I can feel freer? And that, I hope, is that's available at any stage of concentration, any stage of consciousness. And then if you take that as a guide and you do that carefully and thoroughly, careful enough, it'll lead to these other areas in its own good time. But each step along the way is satisfying. But if you hear a teacher like me say, oh, there's these deep stages you have to get to, and then you'll be, you know, this stuff will happen and all that. And then you say, well, I didn't get there, so I just wasted my time. This is frustrating. And I don't want to leave people with that frustration. What I want to leave people is the fact that there's this great process that can be available through mindfulness here and now. And each step along the way is meaningful and valuable and satisfying. And how far you go will depend on many things. But you just have, at least you have the content, you're content to know that it was pretty good what you did so far. Because the alternative was worse.
Two things I got that stood out most in my mind from today was the question about what I do to perceive things as permanent before we broke for lunch. And what I found I like to do is either repeat or recreate conversations or ideas in my mind over and over to make them feel like they're permanent. Because if I don't hold them in my mind, they're not permanent and they just go away. So that was something I looked at, and I noticed that it's more natural for me to have a tendency to recreate conversations which don't make me happy than it is for me to reproduce and hang on to conversations that do make me happy.
That's so the permanence of pain.
Yeah.
That holding on.
Yeah. So that was one thing. And this morning, when we were about to begin the meditation, what's it called?
Choiceless awareness.
Choiceless awareness. The way that it was described as whatever's loudest, and that image of this louder and this louder, and I suddenly felt very, very anxious and could only imagine my children coming at me with louder and louder voices because they tend to gang up on me at times. And if one of them is saying something, the other one has to say at the very same time, you know, this is more important, you know, this is more important. And so my first reaction, my knee-jerk reaction was, I can't sit with this. And then I noticed two things that followed right after. One was that here I don't have to respond to any of the things that are getting louder. And the other thing that occurred was, the loudest thing in that moment was my reaction, and to become mindful of my reaction, and to give that as much attention as I could. One thing that I think for me I'm growing from is the combination of being here and having that awareness in a less challenging environment. And then also, I have done meditations, silent meditations, with my kids active around me, but them knowing that I was going to remain silent and not respond. Yeah. Now, my littlest one has a little trouble with that, but we're training her. But noticing my internal knee-jerk reactions still there, wanting to get swept into that whole scene is really bringing me more mindfulness about how caught up I really am and what I'm doing that maybe I don't need to do, how I'm responding when I maybe don't need to be responding.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. So, yeah, so it's a hugely important area is understanding our reaction, our response, all this extra stuff we add on top of stuff. And more likely it's we're just, you know, there's this kind of cliche in our circles. It's not sounds that are bothering us, we're bothering the sounds. You know, it's the way we're reacting and relating to what's going on, which is really the source of stress, you know, more often than not. So those are two good things. Thank you. So, so the way that we see permanence, or the way that we, you know, if things are always in flux and changing, or if the mind is open and porous to the experiences coming through, it's interesting to notice where we get hung up. Where does the mind stop? You know, so for example, you know, there's all these sounds. For example, you can be sitting here, there's all these sounds in the area. Maybe you're doing listening meditation. It's all very fine until someone drives by in a Harley. And, oh, Harley. It'd be nice to go on a Harley. Wouldn't it be nice? You know, yeah, you know, it's a nice sunny day, you know, and Highway 101 is so close by. It would just be a gas, right? And so the mind has stopped, in a sense. It has left the stream of the present moment, the stream of impermanence, the change, and gotten caught in these kind of thoughts. And so when does the mind stop? As opposed to when does the mind just stay open and let everything kind of move through? So that's a very interesting question for meditation. What does the mind get hung up on? When does the mind... And chances are that when the mind gets caught or when the mind gets hung up, that's the time also where you start put an overlay of permanence onto your experience because you got involved in concepts, ideas. And impermanence is a wonderful teacher anytime. And here in the, as a 13th stage of the stages of breath meditation, it really is, here it's following in the heels of all this practice earlier that's going on. And in fact, some teachers will say that when you get to the impermanence stage, seeing impermanence, you actually need to go back and review all the earlier ones. Or as you go do your meditation, continue to do your meditation, start seeing those different stages, different experiences through the vantage point or through the point of view of impermanence. See the impermanence is there as well. And maybe also to hold it lighter then, to be looser with it. And so then there's a shift of relationship. This whatever seeing into impermanence involves a shifting relationship. And so the 14th and 15th stage speaks to this changing relationship. So the next time we meet, we'll explore that a little bit. And so what follows from the mindfulness of impermanence.